Welcome back, everyone. I hope you're enjoying this series as much as I do. I actually look forward to going into the sutta in a depth because how I'm working this thing, it's very important for you to understand. You can take a literal translation of what's being said, and that's always has some value. But you can also take the implication or the implied value of what's being said. And that's far deeper and richer. And so on each of these little sutta passages that we read, I'll give you both a literal, but also more importantly, the implication. What is this thing setting us up? What's the implication of what's being said here? And I think that most Buddhists are much too literal, that they just take what's being said and they don't vary it at all. They don't allow themselves to go out and explore what it means to have this setup that the Buddha is talking about here. What does it mean? And what does this imply to our basic practice? Because the implications have very deep significance for our spiritual orientation, and I hope that will come out tonight as we speak. But what I want to start with this evening is a couple of very basic questions that I posed last week to the small group. And one I think that's very important for us to consider on an ongoing basis is, what is the spiritual? What does it mean to be spiritual? And if you haven't considered that question, and if you just find yourself meditating, then where are you going? What's the direction you're taking? Because the spiritual journey is the journey towards the sacred. Now, some of us have a very superficial understanding of what the spiritual means. It's like past life regressions or Ouija boards or seances or something of that nature. And although those may challenge our particular way of viewing the world, they don't deeply touch the heart of what the sacred means in any way. So for us to look very deeply at the definition of the sacred and see whether our spiritual journey, which is the journey towards the sacred, is in line with this deeper aspect. Rather than getting lost, and I mean, there are 10,000 tributaries to this mainstream. And believe me, if you have any desire for any of them, they will be very alluring to you when you come to that particular aspect or depth of your practice. Some of the ways that there will be different sensitivities that you will have that will come up where you'll know things that you don't know with a grosser mind. And the other thing I want us to consider is the way we practice, which is also has tremendous impact on not only how we practice, the way we practice, but also what we see or allow our practice to show us. And if I can just give you some very quick examples of that, if you are a person that is very dependent, doesn't like, needs to follow orders, and sort of stay in line and never challenges the status quo, then you're going to be locked up into a very defined relationship to your practice, and that's going to require, that's a very small world, because you'll never challenge your own limitations. And therefore, that lack of challenging will create a contraction of the Dharma. So the Dharma needs to be explored, needs to be pushed, it needs to be challenged all along the way. But if we have that tendency of mind, or if we're a very anxious person and are afraid to feel the subtle nuances of fear that any practice will bring, then when our practice begins to look at the boundaries of where we have resisted a greater meaning or greater implication of meaning for ourselves, and those boundaries start getting pushed back, we'll start feeling that anxiety and we'll implode and be, we'll shut ourselves off like that. So to understand one's character and the limitations of one's character is very important as to how and what and what and what we do when we practice, and to challenge these limitations all along the way so that we don't just assume that that's my character and I don't know what to do, that's just what I'm... No, but to really look at these things and to keep ourselves pressing forward if we find some kind of restraint and contraction within ourselves that keeps us from really exploring the way that this needs to be explored. So what? How is it that we define the sacred? And I have been defining it as that which is not created by thought. So if we're on a spiritual journey to the sacred, please follow this, then our practice must point in a way that doesn't limit, that thought becomes less and less compelling, less and less a force to bear upon us, right? In other words, a quieter life, a quieter mind. I mentioned the continuum from noise to stillness, and that's a very nice continuum, the way I'm defining the sacred at the moment. So this sense of the practice and all of these sutta references, they should line up. They should be in a line with the definition of the sacred, of something of less compulsion of thought, of a quieter, a less complicated life. It shouldn't be a it should be very simple. This thing should be very simple. If it's very complicated, you can be assured that you will be thinking a lot, right? Or if it has too many tasks for you to do, or too many things that you have to do, too many alterations, or too many groupings and all of this, then where are we losing that simplicity? What way, how are we defining our practice where we're losing that simplicity within this complexity? The mind will want the complex. It will look forward to being a challenge through the complex, through the complicated, through the sophisticated. It likes that. That's its path. That's its life's path. But the heart, which is the sacred, which is the stillness aspect, is satisfied only through the stillness of life. And so those are the rubs that are going to be along the way. We're going to get pushed by the mind, but we're compelled by the heart. And so we have to learn how our practice can be moving mentally and denying that beautiful and endearing traction of simplicity, just because it feels good to know a lot. So just to be careful, and remembering also that any wise person, wise woman, wise man that's ever lived is no different than you or I. No different. What they have been able to discover that we might not have been able to discover is the dimension of stillness that each of us hold. And so don't look outside of yourself towards some wise person or prophet for that stillness. If it isn't in us, it's not worth practicing. We aren't going to find it on some field. It's not going to be a scavenger hunt. This is either inside of us intrinsically, or we're wasting our time. So this sutta takes us in that direction. It guides us in that direction if we know how to read the implication of what it's saying. So let me read this next exercise that it brings up, and then I'll give some words to it here. So it says, furthermore, when going forward and returning, he or she makes him or herself fully alert. When looking toward or looking away, when bending and extending his or her limbs, when carrying his or her outer cloak, her upper robe or her bowl, when eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, when urinating and defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and remaining silent, he or she makes himself or herself fully alert. Well, there's just a comment I want to make about the use of words, and I think it's the vernacular of the time and how it's been translated, but I take issue with makes him or herself fully alert rather than becomes fully alert, right? It's not of your effort. Full alertness is not of your effort. And this implies that it is. So I reject that. I reject that. Why? Because it's not the truth. Experientially, it's not the truth. So out it goes. And that's the way you should approach this thing. If it's not the truth, out it goes. So I don't have to, well, maybe somebody's comments, an editorial says that it is, and maybe no, it's not the truth. Period. That's it. I know that, so then I say that it was translated wrong or poorly or something. So that's gone. But it leads an awful lot left, and we shall move right into this. First of all, fully alert, in all aspects of life. This is the full catastrophe. This is the full Monty. Huh? This is life uncloistered. So get the feeling. He's not, when he says, doing eating, drinking, chewing, defecating, urinating, he's not leaving anything out. Right? Well, he didn't say brushing your hair. No. He says brushing your hair. Everything. All right. So this full alertness, what does this mean? You see what? The implication is, should we be mindful? Like, oh my God. No, or is there this abiding, relaxed awareness that our life manifests out of, rather than trying to procure a mindfulness to each and everything we do? Get the difference in that. Okay, so now it's a question of my disposition in the moment. If I'm leaning into it with my agenda becomes so important that I forget to relax and receive life so that awareness can abound. Rather, I get tied up in the doing of my practice, which is the mindfulness in each moment, and it's unrelenting because he's not giving me any breaks here. And so it's either going to tie me up in a knot and break me, because you try it. Eating, drinking, chewing, savoring, urinating, defecating, standing, walking, you try it. It'll break you. Or you'll try a different disposition to this. See, he's implying a different disposition, a complete change of paradigm here. I can't do this. Which is why he makes himself fully alert just doesn't go into this. See, so we read the intention in the words. Now this is, we open up the moment to fully abide within that stillness. See, because if I keep thinking that I need to do all this, I'm getting noisier because I'm missing some of them and some things I'm not, and I'm trying to control all my mindfulness. I'm getting noisier. I'm not getting quieter. I'm losing the sacred. I'm not accessing the sacred. You see how important the definition, knowing the definition of what we're doing, and then bringing the sutta alongside that definition. The full catastrophe. And then, secondarily, the Buddha seems to be saying not to draw any distinction between the spiritual and the secular. Because he's not saying sitting, you know, special, urinating, not special. He puts sitting and urinating side by side. Right? The spirit, wait, what? What? This is confusing to me, you know. I never thought of a holy pee. The holy sea, but not the holy pee. This is very strange. You see, but it breaks down, starts breaking down all the barriers that we impose. And what happens when we start breaking down self-imposed barriers? We become less compelled by thought, less contracted, less demanding of our spiritual journey, less controlling, which I will get to in just a minute. So that sense of the breakdown between, see, there's implying. This is where you're using what is said. No, where does he say that breakdown? And it doesn't say that. It's implied in what it said. The distinction between the spiritual and the secular, it's gone. There isn't such a thing. There's no division here. How can there be a division? There'd be two. It's either all one or all the other. That's right. Because if it's spiritual, it's all spiritual. It has to be. If there's any spiritual thread, then it all has spiritual thread. Well, now it begins to make sense to me. Now, in the second component of this, is it broadens the definition that it's all times. It's at all times. Not sometimes. It's all times. And the prioritizing of actions and environments is shot, dead, gone. What about Cloud Mountain? What about Spirit Rock? Gone. You have to be ruthless. But then your life works perfectly. When it's gone, your life works perfectly. When it's there, your life doesn't work perfectly. You lean. Well, if I really had it together, I'd do a residential retreat. This is not about leaning. This is standing upright. This is finishing. So it has to go. There can be no more leaning. Special environment, special actions, doing my mala beads, reciting my prayers, looking at my puja table, lighting incense. Here's one, Northwesterners. Walking in nature. Gone. Sitting here, right this moment, full Monty. This is it. Doesn't get more special, doesn't get more holy, doesn't get more sacred. See what this thing implies? Just reach it. We can reach it. Don't hold it down. Don't cramp it within our small world's definition. Well, let's see. Okay, doing this, I got to do that, I got to do this, I got to do that. No. This is an abiding awareness in which all things move. And it's beautiful when you see it like that. It comes to life. It stands up. It's fully energized, fully itself. Now, the next thing it implies, since it includes all things and at all times, there's no way to control the Dharma. Because all control is an exclusion of something else, isn't it? Whenever we try to control something, it's to get us away from something that we don't want or is out of control. But this entires the this implies the elimination of all barriers and therefore the elimination of all control. See, it's a shout. It's like stuff it expander. It's like this sutta has been so stuffed by people's commentary over 2,500 years, it needs to be put into a stuff it expander. And suddenly you get a whole different way of looking at this thing. Not what Buddha Gosa said in 12th century. But what's life right now? Where does this thing come alive right now? And it does. If we're courageous enough to move with it. But again, if the way we practice is very contrived, very threatened, oh, just tell me the right thing to do, please. I don't want to ever make a mistake in my spiritual practice. It won't work. And each of us have a character that we need to be aware of in that way, because it'll stand in our path. And this need to control, the more, well, I mean, just look at it from our definition of the sacred. The more we try to control, the noisier we become, the tighter and more contracted we become. The tighter we become, the noisier we become. We must realize that being in control is counter to the very definition we set out to discover. This isn't the sacred. I'm not going to control my way to the sacred. It doesn't work. I tried. It doesn't work. Got to give it up. I gave it a good shot. I just wore myself out. Huh? We get out of the way. We get out of the way. Our agenda is set aside. See, this is the key. This is the key. We set our agenda aside. This awareness is ever present, but our agenda gets in the way of this ever present awareness because we're so sure and determined that we know what we're doing. Well, we may know what we're doing, but that's not the spiritual. And so there's a way that we fall back into the spiritual to allow ourselves access. And some of us are so tired. I mean, I was once with a Tibetan monk. I was a Theravadan monk staying at Ajahn Buddhadasa's. And the Tibetan monk was always doing something. And I said, what's your practice? And he said, well, I do 100,000 mantras of this, and I do prostrations, and I do... I mean, he gave me a list that would... Like it was a full-time job, just getting a list done. And he said, what's yours? I said, I try to relax, I said. I don't think he thought much of me there. Our agenda gets so important to us, doesn't it? Because it's self-driven. It's coming from the organ that complicates rather than simplifies. We should at least realize that we have one organ here that will forever complicate. And if we run things through it, our life is going to be complicated, dramatic, explosive. Well, it works against full awareness. Fully alert, fully aware, he says. Where's the breath? Fully aware. Now the paradigm switches. Because if we're not in control, how do we get it? You see the question? And so the paradigm switches from getting it to surrendering to it. And that's a crucial rub. That's a crucial rub. So the question really is whether you want it or not, because it's as available as it is and has been for 2,500 years. It's no more or less available. And people who have discovered it have had to work their way through this maze of mind-heart to find their way towards simplicity, to rediscover, to refresh it, refresh button. And so suddenly movement breaks things apart. You see, sitting still has its point, but there's a whole way that movement brings flexibility and pliability in. And so movement, I mean, a few paragraphs back in the sutta, so this is walking, you know, sitting, standing, lying down, it already brought movement into it. And now there's something beautiful about movement, because again, it doesn't let us freeze our position in some kind of way that statues seem to proclaim. And so movement, the sense of movement in all of this, flexibility, change, adaptability, doing what's appropriate, rather than what was on my list, my checkoff list to do. That comes from the moment. It's an interactive. It's an arising from the moment, better said, than interaction. But it is interactive. But it's interactive from the whole of the moment, rather than from a calculation about what I'm going to do in the moment. This is alive. It's not stayed or contracted. It's alive. It's vibrant. And he's bringing vibrancy into this. So the movement expands the reach and expands the circumference. This is big. This isn't small. This isn't contained. It starts out, you know, mala beads and chanting and sitting meditating. But this thing gets big. This thing gets as big as the universe. It gets as absolutely compelling as the universe as a whole. That's why I keep bringing in stories about cosmology. We stay so contracted in our little, you know, you look up and you go, oh, a shooting star, my God. Non-doing. The doing of agenda and the non-doing of surrender. You're just surrendering your agenda. That's all you're doing. You're surrendering what you thought you were going to do to what is arising for you to do in this moment. What is appropriate? What's appropriate? Is appropriate? It's a good word. Now, the other thing that is implied in this sutta is that all the sense organs. This is a sutta that implies all the sense organs. And therefore, you know, it's a full hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting. It's all of that. All the sense perceptions are alive in the sutta. And then there is the willingness to be reborn, to be born anew in the moment, just as the senses are coming in, rather than the conditioned reference that we give to each sense door. So that's one of the implications. Another implication of this is that there's awareness of the senses. Not so much an investment in the content or the thought about what the senses are bringing forth, the consolidation, the way the senses bring forth a determined and purposeful universe. Rather, it's the awareness. What is it that's seeing? What is it that's hearing? What is it that makes it capable of hearing or seeing or smelling or tasting or touching sensation? So awareness blankets the sense doors, surrounds the sense doors. And when we're not lost on how the mind consolidates and programs and organizes the sense data into a kind of worldly view and then gives us a depiction of person and need within that view, and then we work out our life through that view. When we just go back to the senses themselves, they're very mysterious. They don't imply a person. You know, whoa, this is interesting. And I also really appreciate the fact that he threw in urinating and defecating. And why do I appreciate that? Because he takes what was and is a repugnant feature of most of us. We don't like to think of anything below the waist belt. Keep your thoughts up above the waist, right? And then he makes them human. He brings them into the field. And so we can't get out of what's repugnant. We can't somehow avoid, you know, he said, brings it into the daily slop of being a human being, of the coughing, sneezing, phlegm, blood and sinews, whatever a sinew is. It's in there. I like that. He's not trying to be high-minded, you know, because, or to keep from offending. There's all of this, the complete human. And believe me, the next stanza, which we will go into on the next talk, he really gets into the repugnant. And we'll go much more deeply into that. But remembering that this is, what we're doing here is we're in the foundation of the body. So I want to repackage or reorganize this to come through the body. This is the body foundation. The first foundation, we're still on that. For those of you who might have been adrift. So this is all happening within the sense perceptions of the body. It's the ground of our being. You see, it's contains the quietude we seek. We've just jabbed it and invested it with so much noise that when we enter it, it doesn't feel very quiet. It feels emotional or whatever it is that we've invested in it. But it in itself, when we allow that conditioning to abate, rests in stillness. And it's just as I'm speaking, just come into your body. Just let it rest in stillness wherever you are. You don't have to worry about missing the words. You can hear. You don't have to try to hear. Hearing happens. You don't have to let the words form a whole world view, though. And this sense of groundedness, it can compel us to be noisy because we have so much invested in this body. And we have defined it throughout our years. We never allow it to seek the quietude, to have the plumb line rest in zero. We always swing it. You know, it gets too quiet, we swing it. We complain about it. We don't allow, there doesn't have to be any complaints. There, pain and aging, pain is an aging. Where's the complaint? You didn't think you're going to age? It gets sick, it gets well. We think wellness is our birthright, but not sickness. Finding that ground. And we can, it's a beautiful instrument. It's the perfect instrument because it's the full Monty. It's there, whatever is going on, it's part of the scene. And when we feel the contraction of our emotional pain, it's the perfect place to investigate that pain from because it gives us stability, it gives us footing on which we can explore that pain. So we're out walking and suddenly we see somebody who we have some reaction to, the body is showing us that. We're feeling the reaction from the body. And we can explore what that means or what that's about in the moment. And I don't mean intellectually. I mean you can feel the contraction. You can feel where you're circumstantially bending things, trying to get out of yourself, defend yourself, not wanting to be yourself, not allowing. There's an assumption going on in there. All of these things can be seen and felt from the inside of the body, but not if you're 2 feet from the body. And so the body's a beautiful stabilizing influence and allows us to continue the exploration of the journey wherever it's happening, on retreat, off retreat, interacting in solitude, eating, defecating, urinating. Let the body call us back to itself. I mean, when the Buddha touched the earth, that was it. There was no argument that Mara could make after that. I'm here. This is it. I don't offer you no excuses for being here. I offer no apologies. This is where it is. I couldn't be any other place, and neither could you. We are only in the place we can be. We owe no apology for being where we are. Period. That's it. Now let's stop doing it. Let's just end that one. And if there's a psychological moaning and wiggling, then let's deal with that. But let's not create any more anxiety for the body, because the body's in its rightful place. Let's deal with the mind that is trying desperately to create its own sense of purpose and intention and meaning and being, which means that it has to be very noisy a lot because the body keeps calling it back to quietude. The mind has to be continually noisy, isn't it? It does a good job, doesn't it? It's amazing. It can't stop for very long, or you'd lose your reference. You'd say, well, this is a fake. I've been going on the wrong. It doesn't want that, so it continues. When you're sitting, when you're lying down, everywhere, it just continues, continual chatter. Most of us live so immersed in despair and worry because our agendas are self-created, mentally created, that we lose the ground of our being. We're never where we're supposed to be. The sense of being a walking shame is because we're never where we're supposed to be. We're always a little bit out of alignment. Nonsense. How could this thing be out of alignment? Even if it were quadriplegic, how could it be out of alignment? To recover that ground, the earth, as my witness to my shame, earth, to my doubt, earth, bear witness. Do I need, should I be, could I be, should I excuse a pop? No, the earth says. The earth says no. Stand straight where you are, which is why we sit straight. Because if we didn't, soon the emotional and psychological folding in on ourselves would cripple our seeing. But we sit straight, shoulders square. Wherever what comes, the earth, through that straightness, no leaning, straightness. What a beautiful tool, and we have it for such a short period of time. It holds the whole message of the Dharma, and we keep looking outside of it. And here it is. within this fathom-long body, the Buddha said, the world is created. The shame of being me, the sense of self-judgment. All we need to do is sit. Which one are we going to believe? We don't even feel deserving our own heart. We don't feel deserving of our own goodness. Believe me that there's basic goodness. But you can't talk your way out of it. I mean, many of you have tried to do that, and you aren't going to talk your way into stability. You've just got to see that this is just, you've been told one continuous lie. Your mind has just been asserting its psychological opinion upon your basic being. It's been arguing with something that's inarguable. I am here, period. To question that conditioning, we find the untruth. We discover the truth by revealing the untruth. God, look what I've been saying to myself. It's just like this little person in there that's just saying this whole story. It has nothing to do with anything. It has nothing at all to do with anything. Have you ever come out of a movie? You've spent 2 hours in a movie. And maybe it was a dramatic movie. You come out and you carry the movie with you, and you like feel the movie and what other people are doing and around. You ever had that experience? Yeah. That's what we're doing, except we carry the movie with us all the time. And the whole frame of reference is the movie we've been telling ourselves. And so when anyone moves, it's in relationship to the movie we've been telling ourselves. Has the drama, the attitude, the feeling, the ambiance. It's the movie. So that's why, in your homework, I ask you to write down 4 or 5 action statements that you will take to deny the untruth, to invalidate the untruths that lead most of our lives. Now, if you don't do that, if you think it'll just kind of trickle down somehow through my words and at some point you'll just be stepping out of this, think again. This does take focus and intention on you, by you. You have to set this thing in motion. And that's where most of us fear, because we really believe the untruth. We believe it. And so when we set an action to counter that untruth, the action is what falters. The untruth sustains itself. So the first thing we have to do is to look at that untruth and to see that it's untrue. Very easy to do. Anything you're telling yourself is untrue. That's the rule of thumb. You can see it. Don't take my words. See it for yourself. It's a perspective, it's an attitude, it's a story, it's not the truth. And when you begin to see that, we get locked in the inaction. The story still has its implication. We've seen the untruth, but we can't seem to move it in a way that moves it in any alignment to true. And so we stay acting untruth even though we know that it's untrue. And that just reaffirms, and at some point it comes back in, solidifies back out as untruth, and we start believing it again. Because the actions will carry the assumptions. So this takes some courage here. So we're walking down the street, feeling the shame of our life, woke up that way, probably has spent decades that way, and we're walking down and somebody looks at us and asks us a question, and we're feeling this shame. Now, in my action statements, I said, when this shame is occurring, I challenge it, I look at it, I ask whether this shame is a story or whether it is the moment that's arising. Is it true in this moment? And then I bring my action statements to bear upon that. I look them in the eye. I tell them the best way to get to X or Y. Even though inside they're saying, who are you to give directions to? I don't know the situations, people, that we're in, but you know the feeling I'm trying to intone here. That's what we're going at, the difficult ones. The ones that we have lived with our entire life. Those. I'm not going to live with them anymore. And slowly, as we take that firm resolve, remember it's a parami resolve, the conviction of heart, it's not a force of will, it's a conviction of heart. We start trying to figure out how to move this thing, and is there awkwardness, but it starts moving. It starts, the fluidity of it starts going in a wise direction. And suddenly the shame we thought was so prevalent, and was so prevalent for so long, it's like barely there. It's like it's a whisper or something in the back. It doesn't even hold us anymore. It's like a beeper of a stove, you know. You're in another part of the heart and did I leave something on the burn? No, I didn't. There's nothing on the burn. Okay. So this is our work. This is where the sutta has taken us. This is the implication of the sutta. And we thought it was like brushing my teeth, scratching my hair, urinating, defecating. Well, I thought that's what it was about. It wasn't about that. Wasn't only about that. If your strict interpretation of the Constitution is about just what the Constitution says. But this is a new time. Bring some aliveness in this thing. Let's expand it out. Let's walk out of this thing. Full embodiment. Full health, full sanity, full freedom. Thank you. Let us sit for a minute or two. Body straight. Sit with confidence, your body confidence. Sometimes all you need to be told is that you're as strong as you are. Because everyone around you wants you to be weaker, as weak as you think you are. That keeps them in their judgment, in their projected story. Now you know that's enough of that. Just enough. So let the way you sit hold that determination. What sound or smell or taste or sight or thought can take you away from that? What emotion? Nonsense. Okay. So if you have any questions or comments or anything you'd like to say, I needed to give this talk some energy. Because I feel like some of us are wavering a little on our own stamina, but also our own confidence level. You come and you listen to another talk. What is this, talk 12, 13 of this series? It's like, okay, right, I'll take a little note, put it down. Maybe I'll be hanging up on my refrigerator along with my homework. Nothing changes. Nothing happens. You take yourself by the shoulders and give yourself a spiritual shake. This isn't a good time. I mean, maybe you're having a good time, but this isn't supposed to be a good time. It's not about, you know, like yoga, you can wear off some or get some exercise and lose a few pounds, maybe, I don't know. But you come here, what do? You don't get a, you don't, there's no exercise. You just listen. What happens? It's like a can with a hole in it. And then it's just all. So I expect more of you. I do. People who don't want this don't come, but you come. So I expect more. Okay, questions or comments? Yes.
I'm a little confused about the whole.
Okay.
In that, one of my patterns is when these limitations of belief and about myself come up, I very quickly go to strategies for trying to deal with them, kind of an action plan, and skip over really being, you know, knowing that it's painful and it's suffering.
Good.
So.
Right.
So, right.
Right. Right. Right. Right. No, 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 no. In fact, one of your action plans would be don't strategize. You see? I mean, I put strategies in there for people who get stuck and can't strategize about any other way to be, so they get stuck in the way they're being. But strategizing can be a compensation, right? For not feeling the pain. So first and foremost, we feel the sense of the false assumption we have. And I don't need to go have every individual interviews with all of you to say that's a false assumption, that's a false assumption, that's a false. I'm giving you, this is it. It's all false assumptions. Now if you want to come individually, that's fine. But that's what I'll tell you individually. It is. It's true. It's false assumptions. So you have to prove that. It's not good enough to write it down, put it in your pocket and say, he said. You've got to see it. You've got to realize it for yourself. Oh, God, look what I've been doing. It's like waking up to death. You know, oh, I knew I was going to die. No, you're dying. Oh, my God. It's like that, right? It's like water in the face. That's what, this is a realization. When we realize that we've been telling ourselves lies, not that it seems I'm convinced of it. No, you're not convinced of it. You realized it. Say, whoa, I've been carrying around this saga forever. And it's just been, it's like just, it just comes forth. Given the right set of circumstances, this saga, this feeling, this assumption comes forth. Whoa. And it's, look, right from here, what's it defining? It's not defining me. It's not defining anything. It's just a story I've been telling myself all along the way. So the first thing to do is to feel that, to really get a realization. And then the reason I put so much emphasis on this next point is because this is where most people falter. It's not in the textbooks anywhere. Most people have the realizations, have the insights. If you've been diligent in your practice over the years, you've had insights about yourself. You've seen it. But you haven't, many of us haven't done anything, haven't created a new life for ourselves outside of the conditioned way that those old assumptions keep patterning themselves in behavior. It's a far, far different to actually integrate into the body, the stillness it deserves by no longer following the assumptions. So at first we this is an artificial thing. We lay out four or five things we're going to do and set ourselves up and rehearse them and all that. But that's an interim step. So you all realize that that's an interim step between spontaneity. But it balances the equation out, so we're no longer following the old conditioning, the old physical action sequences. He says this, I say that in defense. So, okay, so now we've gotten that step. The next step after that is to be still and to see what is appropriate or spontaneous to come. But that few people can get from conditioning to stillness without this intermediate step. Because the body's movement, wise action to me is one of the key links in this Eightfold Path. Yes, you have to have the insights. Yes, you have to, but if you don't translate that into the tissues and cells of our being, it stays up there. And this is a cellular freedom. Yes, sir.
I've been struck by that poem, and I'm this poem about the heart. And as you were talking about being directly in contact with our bodies and throwing away the agendaless energy, without trying to make it too oversimplified, it sounds a little bit like what a heart
It's what the hawk did the first time it stepped off the branch. And that's why one of the ways that I would encourage us to use the body is towards quietude. Don't get so lost in all the stories in the mix. That'll drain itself out if we don't keep compelling it in. It has a limitation. It's got its own quantity that has to come out. Fair enough. So we don't discourage it flowing out, but neither do we dam it up. And even as it's moving, when we're not so assured of the truth of what it's saying, we can get quiet with what it's saying. And the body holds a beautiful sense of stillness. And that stillness is not, and this is a key point, we have to let go of the definition of the body for that stillness to be complete. We can't contain the stillness by keeping it within the body because it flows out of the body. It's much more vast than just the body. But the body is the tuning fork that allows us to enter and then release the definition of body and become the universe. Literally. So there's much more to this story than where we went tonight, but then there's much more of the sutta, isn't there? And I will keep you on course. That's my promise. So we'll call it a night on that, and then we'll have announcements this evening. So if the announcer could...